From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a conversation between friends. One identifies as a political conservative, the other a progressive. And the subject of climate change comes up. The conservative friend rolls his eyes and smiles. "Let's not waste our time with this," he says. "You're not going to convince me, and I'm not going to convince you. I wasn't part of this conversation, but I witnessed it at a dinner party just a few weeks ago, and I wondered, why is it so easy to predict someone's politics simply based on how they view the science behind climate change? Well, local climate activists have been telling us for a long time that their efforts will ultimately fail if this is strictly a cause of the political left only. They need allies. And this hour, we're trying to turn stereotypes around a bit. It's a conversation with several people who are, if we're using labels, and we'll talk about labeling and the power of labels, the deleterious effect of labels. But if we're labeling a bit, some of our guests this hour are on the right or center right of the political spectrum. And yes, they're concerned about climate change. We're going to talk about what viable ideas might be within reach and how we can bridge divides or depolarize these kinds of conversations. My guests this hour include John Kalia, an executive coach and the author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. Nice to have you in studio.
Thank you very much, Evan. It's glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Paul Kane is with us, media team lead for the Rochester chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan. I'm excited to be here.
And on the line with us is Kyle Thomas, group leader of the Syracuse chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, the Citizen Climate Lobby state liaison to political conservatives, and the principal engineer at Natural Systems Engineering. Kyle, did I get it all?
I think you got it all. Thank you.
Thank you for being with us here. Yeah, before this program began, we had a number of conversations with not only folks from the climate lobby, but also people that I know around town here, people like John Kalia, people who, if we had to affix labels, might be center right. And, you know, sometimes, John, as you've written, whether it's in your blog or for the Democrat and Chronicle or elsewhere, when we get too affixed to labels, we instantly kind of ratchet up the polarization and we stop listening. And I think for a moment you were reluctant to even come on today for that reason.
Well, I was. Because the initial question was, are you a conservative? And I don't even like that label. I think there's context to that. A lot of people, if you say you're conservative, tag you with a whole bunch of beliefs that you hate kids.
You must be wealthy and greedy.
I'll give you a quick example. If I say to you, I have a gay son, and I'm really delighted that he was able to marry his longtime partner, and that's the only thing you know about me, the tendency is to tag me as a liberal and to tag me with all those beliefs. If I say to you, I believe in smaller government and a balanced budget, and I think we should be downsizing the federal government, you tag me as a conservative and you tag me with all those beliefs. Both of those headlines are true of me personally, but neither one of them suggest, to me at least, that I should be tagged with all those other beliefs.
Okay, so if you're talking to friends and the subject of labels comes up, mm-hmm. and the notion of conservatism comes up. Mm-hmm. Are there assumptions about you when it comes to climate change?
I don't know that I've encountered that in particular, but usually somebody will come straight at me with a question about which I consider to be a presumptive question. You know, they might say, "Do you think healthcare is a right?" You know, so that's a question out of left field. We may not have even been talking about healthcare.
Kind of a litmus test question.
Yes, right. You know, so I'll respond by saying, well, that question confuses goods and services with rights, which makes them think. So even if we end up disagreeing, that conversation ends up being a little bit more intelligent than just responding viscerally, if you will, to what a question which is almost positioned as an attack.
Okay, so this is one of the reasons I was really eager to have someone like John on the program, because it just seems that the way you think, the way you've written a book, the way you think about business and leadership comes to bridging divides. Fair?
Yes.
We're not just talking climate change. Right. We talk about bridging divides. It's everywhere.
I think that's true. I mean, I was happy to be on the editorial board of the DNC for a while just because I was... It's a reflection of the fact that they want to get it right, and therefore they wanted to have people with different opinions contributing to their editorial view. So I view that as journalism with integrity, and I was delighted to be part of it.
All right, and so before I let our other guests chime in, I'll just ask you briefly, John, as you take a look at the issue of climate change, and again, it's mm-hmm. complex. I don't want to compartmentalize it, so distill it so far down here, but I'll just start with kind of the general question. Mm-hmm. Do you find yourself generally comfortable with the science on it, comfortable that we know enough that that man has had an impact and that we perhaps could have an impact to mitigate?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
And I didn't arrive at that conclusion easily. There's a gentleman I know in Florida named John Englander, and in my various professional roles, I get to meet a lot of CEOs. He's the former CEO of the Cousteau Society, and he's an oceanographer. And when I wrote something in my blog about the IPCC report a couple years ago, he tracked me down, and he pointed out that in his book, he predicted Hurricane Sandy, so he knows a little bit about this stuff, and he just sort of gave me chapter and verse on it. So, I wasn't making a statement in my blog that said definitely not man-made, but I was casting doubt on the science by the language that I used, and he wanted to be clear about that. And so I did a lot more reading, and I talked to a lot of people, but I'm not a scientist. So, and even scientists will tell you that only climatologists are really qualified to
sure.
do this work. So, but the preponderance of evidence suggests to me that in my readings that that climate change is man-made, and that if that's the case, and even by the way, even if it isn't, we know that the waste created by burning fossil fuels is toxic, and there's a tremendous public health hazard associated with it. So yes, we should be addressing it.
But you moved over the last few years by your own reading and by listening to those who reached out to you directly who had more expertise than you.
Yes.
Who are you? And where did you come from in modern political life?
I don't even think of myself as a Republican or a Democrat, although I'm registered as a Republican here in New York. I'm a swing voter. I haven't okay. voted for a winning candidate in a presidential election since 1996. So
that's interesting.
I'm all over the place.
Okay, let me turn to Kyle Thomas on the line with us. And Kyle, first, why don't you give me a little bit more about your own work background as an engineer and how you have viewed this issue over time?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. I'm an environmental engineer by education and profession, and so I've always been plugged in, I guess, to environmental science and pollution matters and protecting our environment, and then sort of independently I have my own political views. And so, I've been aware of climate change for, probably over 20 years. And have been sort of convinced on the science of things and haven't really conflated that with any political views, although I didn't know if regulations or what have you were the way to try to tackle it. I wasn't real sure about what the solution should be.
Yeah, that's actually, this is where I think, and again, I'm going to offer a maybe unfair but a broad-based kind of comment, having observed conversations, dozens of conversations on this program and elsewhere over the years, that maybe climate activists or the political left, generally speaking, I don't know if I say oversteps, but maybe loses the chance to achieve some common ground, because what Kyle just said is not that he doesn't accept some of the science or the expertise on it. It said that he had some questions over whether regulation and government action could be effective, could be trustworthy, could be worthwhile and viable. That's different. I mean, the policy implications are very different than what the science tells us, and that's where the debate is and probably should be. And so, Kyle, have you moved on what you think policy, what kind of policy might be viable in your mind?
Right. Yes, I have. And just to step back to what you, the statement you just made
yeah.
about the science and the policy, a lot of the climate denial that's out there is really based on discomfort with where it leads to from a policy idea. And so in my work, I guess I became convinced a while back that a carbon tax was the way to go. It's just the only thing that can try to tackle all the different ways that we use fossil fuels and burn them and how we're all a part of that, whether it's industry, individuals, or what have you. And that's the way I've been convinced for a long time that that's the way you penetrate the economy. And then when I came across Citizens Climate Lobby and the carbon fee and dividend proposal, just the simplicity of it, the fact that it really is compatible with market-based economies and trying to work within that structure to address climate change, it just it was a big bright light for me. And the fact that the organization is committed to working on a bipartisan basis to get the solution passed, because we just know now that over time that, you know, to tackle something so large, so consequential, it doesn't work to try to tackle it on a partisan basis.
Kyle, what do your friends who identify as Republicans or conservatives say when they find out that you're a Marxist?
Yeah, that's funny when and it sort of gets to the point of your program that once you get defined as a climate activist or somebody that's concerned on the climate, you automatically get excommunicated from the community by a lot of people.
Have you experienced some of that? I'm being cheeky here. And what we want to do is build a world where, whether it's climate change or any big policy issue, we're not immediately excommunicating people just based on one held belief here. But have you experienced some of that?
Oh, definitely. Both in my professional life and probably more so, you know, just socially. And when I interact with people that come from that sort of political idea, they don't accept that I'm a conservative leaning person, or even, you know, that I'm not of like minds with them on many other things, just based on that one issue.
Hmm. Is there anything that you've been able to observe that starts to change that polarization that John Kalia was talking about at the top of the hour, that when that starts to happen, Kyle, can you say, look, we agree on a lot. We don't necessarily agree on this. And let's have a conversation about why. Is that effective in any way?
It is. And I think, you know, one of the things our organization is active in is getting influencers, people that are respected, that speak from a certain perspective, to speak out on it. And that way awakens people. So when you have people like George Shultz, Henry Paulson, Greg Mankiw's, and pretty well renowned economists from the political right speaking out and saying, you know, to not act on what we already are fairly confident about on climate change is a fundamentally not a conservative thing to do. You know, we should be taking out, as George Shultz says, you know, it's an insurance policy that anybody who considers themselves conservative, I guess with a small c, should be interested in.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, when you have those types of influencers that you can point to and say, you know, I think that helps persuade people. Because like I said, when you are coming from it from an individual and you say, I'm a conservative and this is how I feel about climate change, well, sometimes people reject that you're with them, really.
So Paul Kane, media team lead for the Rochester chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby. You know, I think fascinating perspectives from both of our guests so far here. And I wonder if that makes you hopeful that at least, again, what we're not driving at is there's only one solution and the left has the solution, or this is the one policy, or whatever it is. I mean, I haven't even asked John if he's seen anything that he thinks is viable. And John cautioned me before the hour began. Look, I'm not here with expertise on policy. You're more thinking about polarization and conversation, which is great. But are you hopeful, though, that we're starting to bridge divides, or do you see more hardening, generally speaking? In other words, are John and Kyle sort of outliers?
Well, I'm sort of coming from the same perspective as Kyle, because I'm with CCL in Rochester, although if my friends were to describe me, they'd probably say I'm a little left of center.
Okay.
Although, as I said to John earlier before the show, if you want to know what I think about something, ask me. You know, don't label me, right? So I'm very hopeful as a CCL member because of what I've seen that the organization is doing. We just came back from Washington, D.C., where we had an annual conference and a lobby day. We had 1,200 people on Capitol Hill visiting over 500 congressional offices. Personally, I visited two Democrat offices and one Republican office. And the conversation is definitely becoming more open on the political level. but it's kind of under the radar. You know, most of what we hear in the mainstream media and maybe even here at WXXI focuses on what the executive branch is doing right now and what the EPA is doing right now. And it's understandable. But behind the scenes, there is a large group of ordinary citizens, business leaders, thought leaders that have been discussing this. George Shultz's team is one fine example on the conservative side. And by the way, he's on the board of CCL as well. And also ordinary citizens that have recognized, as Kyle so put it so well, that this is really a bipartisan problem. It affects all of us, and it requires a big solution.
Yeah, and so as we continue with our conversation on bridging divides on climate, I think of a conversation on a wonderful podcast called You Are Not So Smart, which is about how we form beliefs and how we understand the world and how often political, and again, sorry, John Kalia, we're going to do the political label thing one more time, how people who tend to identify as political progressives or political conservatives try to debate or convince the other side of the ideological divide. And what it often comes back to is starting with slightly different values. And not recognizing that if you only argue from the standpoint of your own values, you've got almost no chance. You know, so here are two totally different ways to look at climate. Adam Frank, who's a University of Rochester astrophysicist, has a new book on the possible threat to our civilization from climate change. And he just was on a Joe Rogan podcast. He'll be on this show next month. And Adam says, we need to get over this whole doomsday stuff and we're terrible, we destroyed the planet. He said, no, we need to start telling people, it's awesome that we changed the climate. How amazing that human beings, one species in this entire world, changed the climate. That's an amazing achievement. We didn't intend, obviously, intentionally for it to kind of have deleterious effects. We didn't know it would, but it's an amazing achievement that we were able to technologically advance to that point. And we should feel really amazed at what we've been able to do. Well, now, with that knowledge, let's turn our amazement to what we can innovate in a different direction. But let's be positive about it. Let's be impressed with ourselves, and let's have the confidence that we can innovate just as impressively in a different direction instead of we're evil, we're terrible. You know. And so what Adam Frank is effectively doing there is sort of saying, okay, maybe he's not a political conservative, I don't know, in the rest of his life where he stands, but he could say to a conservative, John Kalia, okay, you are someone who cares about innovation, entrepreneurship, individualism, free expression. Nothing says that better than climate change. That's an amazing thing. We don't have to feel bad about that. But now that we know, let's turn it in a different direction. Let's unleash that force. And I find that to be at least a chance to open the door more than just, oh, you don't care about the collective problem of the world? You're not a collective? You're such an individualist that you're greedy and selfish? Well, you're a bad person. I mean, I just don't think that the latter works as well.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, if you look at the current state of affairs, a lot of the economic concerns that conservatives were expressing 10 or 20 years ago have been mitigated by the evolution of the technology or the development of the technology that we now see in place. I mean, solar panels are much cheaper and more and produce more electricity. Electric cars are viable and they're driving on the streets. So we see the impact of that kind of technology and innovation all the time. You might find this surprising, but I thought one of the more positive public policy developments was the EPA plan that Ernest Moniz developed in the Obama administration. Because in effect, it said, here's the 50-year plan. And it said, we're not going to rip up the current infrastructure and replace it at some, you know, multi-trillion dollar cost. It said, we're going to create a plan for each state that considers the current infrastructure. And over time, as the current infrastructure ages out and needs to be replaced, replace it with something that produces green energy. Now, whether the details of that are feasible today or whether they would be feasible as they were planned to be implemented a couple of decades from now isn't really the point. The point is, in principle, they were sort of laying out something that didn't disrupt the economy and did address this need to address climate change. So I thought that was a viable approach. But many conservatives that I talked to at the time, you know, just thought I was running off the rails.
Sometimes it's a matter of what the source of the policy comes from. If you give somebody right. one policy and you don't tell them which administration right. it came from, then they actually have to think about it.
Right.
But if you tell them where it came from,
right.
they have a predisposition
right.
to like
right.
it or hate it.
Right. I think you see that all the time. And our politicians do it. You know, I mean, I've heard Governor Cuomo, for example, poo-poo some data because it comes from a conservative think tank. Well, that doesn't argue that the data is wrong. It just puts a label on something as a way of dismissing it. So these are the kinds of things that I think we endure in our, without thinking about too much. And I think you have to think about it if you want to have a productive conversation.
Kyle, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
I think that's on point. And I just, to your listeners that are interested in this, I think it's important to distinguish between, people on the right. There are some very hardcore people that will deny the science, and probably it's tough to reach them at this point, I would say. But there are many people that are right of center that just really haven't engaged on it that much and haven't made it a priority. And Bob Inglis, who's a former congressman from South Carolina, well known now as a climate advocate, but very conservative in his politics. And he says, it was just something I sort of said, well, Al Gore's against it or for it, for climate action. So I got to be against it. And but then he had his eyes opened, and it's a really great story that he tells. But he had his eyes opened about climate change and said, we have to do something about this. Jerry Taylor is another person. He's with the Libertarian Niskanen Center. He used to be with the Cato Institute and got paid to knock down climate policy and climate science. And he said, but a funny thing happens when you get into it and start to look at it, you become convinced that the science is real and climate change is a problem. And now he advocates from a libertarian perspective to address climate change.
Bob Inglis, by the way, was his children, I think, who first convinced him, all right, Dad, please just take a look. And he promised them
That's
he
right.
would, and he came back after a trip and said, okay, this is not good.
That's
it's just
right.
just fascinating what happens when you kind of get outside the political lens of just team arguments, team fights. And before I let you go, Kyle, because in a moment we're going to bring in another, effectively one of your colleagues, but before we do that, let me just ask you for your thoughts on a very different approach. Here's David Roberts writing for Vox.com, and what he did was he cited the end of last year from the Annual Review of Political Science, Megan Mullen of Duke University said that the conventional wisdom gets the causal arrow backwards. People don't develop political and policy opinions based on an assessment of climate science. They assess climate science based on pre-existing political and policy opinions. And that's why trying to change minds with science-based arguments is so rarely effective unless your name is John Kalia. She didn't write that last part in. I added that. But otherwise, that's the argument she's making. Well, here's what David Roberts says in response to that. He takes the opposite of an Adam Frank, which says, let's look at the positive. Let's think about conservative values. Let's approach it from that point. David Roberts says, no, maybe what we need to do is shame people. He says it may just be that we're not going to get along on this, and the only way to move forward on this is to fight it out. For Democrats, raising intensity would mean making it a fight, staking a claim, defining the core values involved, telling vivid stories with heroes and villains. And in reality, Democrats probably don't have the wherewithal to mount that kind of a fight, but that's the only thing that has a chance of breaking the stalemate. The quest to persuade U.S. conservatives to climate change has been extraordinarily long, vigorous, and well-documented. It has also been fruitless. Perhaps it's time for a little agonism, end quote. So I wonder, Kyle, how you feel about that.
No, I guess I wouldn't agree with that latter approach. And I think that's kind of a mistake that is made coming from the left often, that, there are villains. The oil companies are villains. Greedy politicians are villains. And, I think the approach that frankly, Citizens Climate Lobby takes is the right one. Meet people where they are, where their values lie. And so you can talk to a politician on the right that says, well, I'm not convinced. You can show them all the scientific studies, and then maybe they'll say, well, I'm not convinced that climate change is real, and why should we do something about it when it's so far distant anyway? But then you can say, well, isn't it better if you can incentivize clean energy. As your other guest, John, stated, you know, fossil fuels are polluting in other ways. You know, isn't it better if we can move to a clean energy economy? Isn't it better to tax things like pollution instead of taxing things like income and payroll? You know, tax negative things, tax bads and not goods. And so there are ways to meet people, we believe, and we're seeing that you can get, that we think will gain consensus on this issue.
Kyle Thomas is group leader of the Syracuse chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, the Citizen Climate Lobby state liaison to political conservatives and the principal engineer at Natural Systems Engineering. Thanks for the time and the insight, Kyle. I really enjoyed the conversation with you today.
It was a pleasure. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
All right. We're going to get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with Paul Kane from the Rochester chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby, John Kalia, an executive coach and author of The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. And in a moment, we'll be joined by Kiara O'Brien, vice president of Students for Carbon Dividends, calling from Harvard. So let's get that only break and we continue next. Coming up in our second hour, we're joined by Matt Savage, who plays two shows tonight, the opening night of the Jazz Festival. He's not just a former child prodigy. He's not just a remarkable piano player. But Matt grew up with very little music at all in his life. He was born on the autism spectrum. Sound was difficult for him. So how did he complete this journey to such a successful music career? We find out next hour. And this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about political conservatism, climate change, stereotypes, and bridging the divide if we're going to be looking for solutions. And our guests have been working through that. So some really interesting stuff this hour. And I want to bring in Kiara O'Brien, Vice President of Students for Carbon Dividends. Where exactly are you calling from? I think I said Harvard. I don't know if I was wrong on that.
I'm actually in Washington, D.C.
Of course. Never trust the host. Thank you for taking the time. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Let me just ask you briefly, and before we kind of pick up where we left off, for Kiara, for some of your own background as you assess climate, whether it's policy or just understanding the science, where you've been over the years and where you are now on it.
So I was born and raised in Ketchikan, Alaska, so I've always been very aware of the environment and the climate, and moving to college especially really hammered home the need for a actionable climate policy on the conservative side. I've always been a Republican, and I've finally found a policy that I can support.
Okay, and we're going to talk more about that in a moment. Do you have any fellow, whether it's Republicans of your age cohort or in your parents' generation, who see the work that you're doing for Students for Carbon Dividends and they think, wait a second, I thought you were a Republican?
Oh, absolutely. I've definitely had many conversations, especially with people who are older than me. Not so much in my own generation, but a lot of people do say that carbon dividends are not a conservative policy, but actually like the majority of conservative economists would disagree with them on that.
Okay. Well, before we get back to the policy, there's a couple of things here. I had mentioned what David Roberts wrote for Vox.com about being combative, about deciding that, you know, there's no real hope in persuading someone with evidence anymore, that people are so entrenched in their political tribes that just sort of political warfare and shaming is sort of the way to go here. And John Kalia, I didn't get a chance to ask you what you think of that. I can't imagine you'd endorse that approach.
No, I don't. I think... A big part of the problem is the more centralized or the, let me rephrase that. I'm sorry. This is a problem that can't be addressed locally. It has to be addressed on a global scale. And because of that, we then have to put our trust in institutions that we don't trust anymore. The federal government, the Congress, the federal agencies are just not trusted across the board.
Especially among self-identified political conservatives in this country.
Well, that's true. But I think, if you sort of look at the Pew research on this, it's across the board.
Fair.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you thought about acting locally, there are things that you can do, but you can only have so much effect. So I think that's one of the challenges. I wrote in the book about this just a little bit because in the book, which is actually a business fable, the main character sort of comes to grips with his own personal values when he encounters something going on in his own company, which violates every belief that he has, and it's a legal counsel who's defending the company against an environmental claim. So, you know, how do you come to grips with that if you're a business leader? What do you do about that? And the context here is pretty simple. If you were a plant manager and you were, let's say, managing a chemical plant in a small town, would you want the waste from that plant to be fouling the water that your family is drinking? Or would you want the smokestack, toxic fumes from a smokestack blowing downstream onto the schoolyard where your children is playing? I think the answer is no. Right, so that's one of the reasons why we need regulation. You can't just say, as many conservatives do or many libertarians do, you know, you sort of leave everybody to their own devices and hope that everybody will do what's right. I think that's
or the market will sort out the bad actors.
That's right, but the truth is it hasn't. I mean, if you look at all the great social movements of the 20th century, you know, three of the four of them, I think, were generated as a result of corporate abuse. I mean, there's the labor movement, the environmental movement, the consumer movement, all because corporations sort of violated principles of being a good citizen in their community. So, you know, at our core, as human beings, we are, most of us think of ourselves as someone who will do the right thing, who will be good members of our community. But when cast in a role where you're serving another master, particularly if that's the source of your income, we sometimes violate our own principles. So I think it's incumbent upon leadership, both political, corporate, and community, you know, to start thinking in terms of creating a set of principles that are going to guide us. And if you can create a set of principles that people on both sides of the aisle start to buy into, then you can start to talk about solutions in a different way.
That's why John is one of the really best-selling science fiction authors. The book is called The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. I joke, but I appreciate that so much. And I said the other day at a conference, I grew up with my dad always telling me, you know, one of the things he drilled into me all the time was, do what's right and let the consequences follow. Do what's right and let the consequences follow. And then I told my son that. And I said, you know, when my dad was there, I said, you know who taught me that? That was my dad, buddy, your papa. And he learned that from his dad. And my father said to me, you know, that's nice that you think that comes from our family, but it comes from Cicero. Right. So the idea has been here for a long time, but it's hard to do it. And it's easy to say it. In practice, it's harder to do it. And to get somebody there, I think just shaming, just name calling, just probably only kind of hardens someone.
I think that's true. I think, I'm married to a liberal. We've been married happily, or sometimes happily, sometimes ecstatically, sometimes not so much. But it's a marriage, 37 years, right? So we don't come into the show up in the living room after dinner every night and start arguing about politics. We do talk about politics from time to time, and we have some disagreements and we have some agreements. But if you think in terms of the people that you know, right, your friendships, your family, et cetera, you really don't want to be in a situation where you're constantly at odds with them or where you lose those relationships over politics. I think that's just plain silly. So you have to start thinking in terms of how the relationship should govern the way you deal with any particular issue.
All right, before I go back to Kiara on her thoughts on policy, I know Paul wanted to kind of add, our previous guest brought up Bob Inglis, who was, again, for a little context, listeners, he was a member of Congress, a Republican from South Carolina. He liked to say a red member of Congress in the reddest district in the country. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was every sort of conservative ideal in terms of the political spectrum, whether it was support from the NRA, his views on reproductive health, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he was someone who thought climate change was a hoax because Al Gore said otherwise. And then his kids convinced him to kind of take a trip to listen to a couple scientists. And you really, Paul, you wanted to kind of touch on that a little bit more.
Yeah, I thought that was an excellent point, and I was glad to hear that story. And Kira will remember this because she was at the CCL conference last week, and this observation was brought up that if you look at polls among younger people, so we're talking people between the ages of, say, 18 and 35, that age group is a lot closer between Republicans and Democrats in their outlook on climate change, on the fact that it's happening and on the fact that something needs to be done with it, about it, and the fact that something can be done about it. That's not surprising because they have a big stake in this, right? John and I are showing a few gray hairs here. We're going to be around for hopefully a few more decades, but a few more decades after that, if the predictions are true, and they have been true all along, all through this whole discussion, things are going to get kind of sticky, right? And those are the people who are going to have to deal with that. It's them and their kids. And, you know, the kids are going to solve it, I think. They're going to have to solve it. it would be too bad if we left it to them to solve it, because we can take action now.
Yeah, and this is where I would probably caution progressive listeners not to roll their eyes, because you think about values. Think about where your ideological opponents would put their values if they were listing it. A lot of conservatives are going to write the word family. Right. And resisting the urge to roll your eyes if you're a progressive, right. Think about that. And then think about not just family now, not just your spouse or your children, but their children and their children and their children. And that's where, again, maybe you can kind of something can kind of flower here. When it worked with Bob Inglis.
It worked with Bob Inglis, and the younger generation has, in recent memory, led us on other issues, such as marriage equality. The kids get it right away. You know, they don't know everything that came before. They learn about that through history books and from what we tell them.
Now, careful. You're saying kids know everything. Kids think they know everything.
Yeah. Kids, I said kids get it.
it is fascinating, because on issues like that, that was almost intractable, and then the dam broke, and that moved.
Exactly.
Once it
exactly.
broke, it moved very quickly, and led by a lot of youth voters. That is certainly true. Let me just ask Kira, and then I'm going to grab a phone call from Kathy in Branchport. Kira, tell me a little bit more about Students for Carbon Dividends, because you hear carbon tax, you hear carbon fee and dividend, and why for you, having grown up in Alaska, having grown up with sort of the roots that you have, why did that become the kind of solution on this that you think, yes, this is something we should be grabbing onto?
Yeah, well, all the other solutions that have been out there and have been broached before have all been regulatory approaches. And the Baker-Schultz plan, which is the plan that Students for Carbon Dividends advocates for, is a free market solution. And the basic premise of it is that we can't regulate ourselves out of this mess. It's been tried. And the place that we're in is not a sustainable position yet. So we're a national bipartisan coalition of student organizations spanning from coast to coast. We are currently comprised of 23 college Republican groups, 6 college Democratic groups, and 5 college environmentalist groups. And from my own university, Harvard College, we have all 3 of those groups, Republican, Democrat, and environmentalist, signed on to this coalition, which is not your typical issue. We generally don't see that type of consensus. And so this kind of approach has been really exciting for me as someone who's always been conservative and has never really felt like the environmentalist movement could be a movement that I could be a part of before. And so this plan that we advocate for is really what I look to as the bipartisan approach, but also the conservative approach.
And before I grab Kathy and Branchport's phone call, Kirk, tell me a little bit more about that. You said, you know, given some of the things that you were seeing and experiencing, you didn't necessarily feel like you could be part of the environmental movement. But some people would hear, you know, so here's one of the stereotypes. Well, you grew up in Alaska. Well, you probably have a greater love for the environment than a lot of people. That's a stereotype, but I'm assuming that you experienced a lot with the outdoors. So why was the environmental movement sort of anathema to you?
Well, definitely because of my politics. I definitely heard from the other side that I was a Republican and I didn't believe in climate change. And that's categorically false. I have always understood the science since I grew up learning about it in school. And I think our education system has done a great job with the younger generation to really like hammer home the validity of the science, at least. And so, yes, I grew up in Alaska. Yes, I probably have spent a little bit more time outdoors than the average American. But I don't think that, I think it's a lot of rhetoric and it's a battle of understanding that compromise is not a dirty word, and we can actually work together to find a bipartisan consensus on this issue.
Okay, and again, at the risk of generalizing, which we don't really want to do, instead of asking you sort of a writ large question, let me just ask you, in your own experience, have people, maybe fellow students on the political left, have you felt they have been intolerant of you or not welcoming of you into an environmental movement or made assumptions of you because you're either identified as a Republican or a conservative or whatever in your own background?
I've definitely had assumptions made, but I think once I start having conversations with those people, at least on the individual level, I've been very welcomed. And I think a lot of people on the right have also had that moment where they realize, well, thank you. Like this is a plan. This is here. And this is something I can be a part of. And a lot of what Students for Carbon Dividends is doing is educating. And our motion forward, we are basically trying to do as many campus education events as possible to mostly catch people up on the policy side of things, because this is a really under-promoted policy, in my opinion. I hadn't heard of it until the leaders of this group that started at Yale approached me about it and asked me if this was something I could support. And then doing my research, only then was I really convinced and really brought on board.
Where would you send people to learn more online?
Well, you can come to our website, s4cd.org, or you can check out the Climate Leadership Council, which are the authors of the Baker Schultz Plan.
It's S4 as in the number 4?
Yes, the number 4.
S4cd.com, if you want to check out.
Org.
Oh, dot .org.
.org.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Very good. Let me grab Kathy and Branchport on the phone. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hello. Yes, and I want to say that I do live up on Italy Hill because I love being close to nature and gardening and having animals, especially horses. However, I think that a carbon tax would place an unfair burden, an outsized burden, on those of lower income, because many people who live in a rural area have to commute to a city for a job that pays a decent amount, hopefully an amount enough to support a family. And my husband and I both commute 60 miles each way to work in Rochester. So we would be paying for the carbon tax, I think. And, we make enough so that we would be able to afford it probably. But there are many people in our area who would be paying a carbon tax who couldn't afford it. And I just, really think that there may be unseen consequences consequences that haven't been considered that would be much harder on people of lower socioeconomic status.
Okay, so Kathy, thank you. So, Paul, you want to jump in first?
Sure. I do want to assure the caller that these consequences have, in fact, been considered, and that's the reason for the dividend part of the carbon fee and dividend. So the idea is that we collect the fee at the point of entry of the material into the economy, so the wellhead, the mine, the port of entry. But that is put into a fund that is then paid back to citizens on an equal basis. So it's not like you're just getting your money back, because we're going to give it on an equal basis. Everybody gets an equal share. And that gives everybody an incentive to move to cleaner energy behavior, basically. So yes, if you're a 60-mile commuter, it's going to be in your financial interest to go get a hybrid vehicle, for example, or to get an electric vehicle, or find some other way to reduce your carbon footprint. And if you do those things successfully, you can actually come out ahead.
Yeah, I would love to get an electric vehicle if I could find one that had enough of a range. Mm-hmm. And I do have to apologize a little bit because I missed some of the show, so I missed hearing the description of what a carbon dividend is. So thank you for describing that again. But I'm glad to hear that the point of view that I'm expressing is being considered.
Yeah, Kathy, I think that's important. And again, John's not here to offer sort of expertise on policy, but here's someone who's open to these ideas, but is worried about either unintended consequences or economic consequences. And what comes to mind for you, John?
Well, I like the idea of a carbon tax because, in effect, what it does is it says our goal is to reduce the use of fossil fuels without specifying the means by which we'll get there. Because big regulatory schemes typically don't work. They always create unintended consequences. Paul and I, before we came on the air, we were talking about this in the lobby, and I think I agree with the first half of his solution, the carbon tax. Although I agree with Kathy that it's a highly regressive. I think what we ought to be looking at is whether it would make more sense to tax the power plants, if you will, whether it's the V8 in your car or the natural gas electric utility, rather than taxing consumers through, let's say, a gas tax. The other element of it that I disagree with is the whole idea of a dividend, and because in effect what it does is it says let's create a disincentive to burning carbon, but then let's create an incentive to burn more of it.
To burn carbon,
right? So. I like the idea of perhaps using some of that money to address some of the public health downsides to the burning of fossil fuels or something along those lines.
Let me ask Paul and Kira to weigh in on that, and we'll grab another phone call. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, John and I did talk about this ahead of time. My response is that I don't quite understand why there's an incentive to burn more when there's a higher the prices of the fossil fuels and products derived from them are going up because of the fee, right? And the dividend only works for you if you become a cleaner energy user, right? So that's the incentive. The incentive is not there for you to consume more fossil fuels because then you'll come out behind. Your dividend will not compensate for the increased cost you would be paying that are being passed down to you from the fossil fuels company.
So you're still trying to incentivize people to move to other forms of energy.
To move to cleaner energy.
Okay, and to Kathy's point, it's going to be a bigger hit for someone like Kathy.
Yep, absolutely.
It's going to be harder for people, and that's regressive, isn't it?
That's regressive what we're trying to do here is drive the correct behavior, right? And in doing that, we're also trying to get the market to move along and make those cars that are electric and have a longer range, et cetera, et cetera. And that's not going to happen if we just let pollution be free.
And I guess, Paul, if I'm following, you know, the market, the first television that comes out, the first computer that comes out, the first Chevy Volt that comes out
exactly.
is always expensive.
Exactly.
The more the market produces and sort of normalizes
right.
where you can get them, where they can be serviced, prices tend to come
right.
down a lot. And
right.
that's what you're hoping will happen.
Exactly. And that's what the economists have concluded could happen if this kind of plan is put in place.
Kira, you want to add to that at all?
Yeah, sure. So my state, Alaska, has the permanent fund dividend, which has always given residents the revenue of oil money. But what we've seen in our state is the dividend generated by that has been going down as the pipelines have yielded less oil. And so that money that's been given to Alaskans for years has done what Kathy's talking about, has been making ends meet for rural citizens where the prices of living is higher, frankly, and commuting and getting anywhere is pricey. And a carbon fee and dividend could actually do a very similar thing. And so this type of program, the dividend portion of it is especially important because for the bottom 70% of Americans, you would actually receive more in dividends than you are paying in tax. So then those dollars would then go back into American pockets. And if you were to follow a plan like the Baker-Schultz plan and you would have the regulatory reduction as a third step, then you would have more room for American innovation to be unleashed and to actually make positive change on the environment and the economy while making life easier for rural residents at the same time.
All right, let me just grab a couple other quick bits of listener feedback. Mike writes to us and says, please mention to your guests that climate change occurs with or without the burning of fossil fuels. Mike, that is a common objection to the notion of what climate science is telling us. And it is true. The climate's always, quote unquote, changing. It's just not changing naturally over time as rapidly and as significantly as it has with the impact of human activity. That's the difference. But you're right. It's always changing, just never like this before. And that's why once you actually talk to the people who drill ice cores and measure these things, it's not that hard to see. But I appreciate the idea that it is always changing. Robert in Fairport on the phone. Got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, this sounds like a domestic scheme that's only going to impact companies that are domiciled in the U.S. I'm kind of curious at how it impacts countries like China and India, which each of those countries has about three times the population of America. And I just worry that we're creating an incentive here, a massive incentive to export millions of American jobs to China and India so companies can avoid these carbon taxes. I mean, America is not the entire cause of the problem here with carbon.
All right, Paul. Thanks, Robert.
Yes, that's a very good point. And we didn't get a chance to lay out all the specifics of the carbon fee and dividend, but one of them is also a border adjustment to address exactly that issue.
Where can you learn more?
You can learn more at citizensclimatelobby.org. You can also learn from Kira's website, from the Climate Solution Climate Leadership Caucus, and also from the Rochester chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby Facebook page.
We're down about to our last minute, and I want to finish up with John Kalia, who I dragged in here today, and it was kind enough to say yes here. We've had a good discussion on climate. Let's get some final thoughts from you on going beyond climate and the way we have conversations with one another, that right now it is so easy to find someone who agrees with you, and then it's easy to sort of taunt or kind of dehumanize people who disagree. And I want some thoughts from you on that.
Well, quickly, I would just create one term that we should all introduce into our thinking, and the word is doubt. If you mentioned that I've changed or modified or my position has migrated over time, I think my position on a lot of things migrates over time. And I think the reason is that you have to leave open the possibility you're wrong. even if you consider yourself to be an expert. And the degree to which you then think of things in that respect will enable you to listen better when you're talking to somebody with whom you disagree.
It's a great point. I just saw a clip that is going viral, usually often on the political left in the last 24 hours, of comedian Jim Jefferies sitting with Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson, one of the best-selling authors in the world right now. Mm-hmm. And in 40 seconds in this clip, he gets Jordan Peterson to reconsider his position on the Supreme Court decision on the gay wedding cake decision. And a lot of people are saying, oh, look, he destroyed Jordan Peterson. And my first reaction to that was, wow, at least Peterson's sitting there going, okay, you presented an argument, and maybe I've been wrong. I actually liked hearing that. So I thought, why are we demonizing for someone for saying that? I'm with you. Saying I don't know is powerful. It's profound. And it's really great stuff. John, thanks. Thanks for coming in. Really appreciate it. The book is called The Reluctant CEO, Succeeding Without Losing Your Soul. Paul Kane, the Rochester chapter of Citizens Climate Lobby. We'll see you again. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Evan.
And our thanks to Kira O'Brien on the line with us from Washington, Vice President of Students for Carbon Dividends. Thanks for taking the time, Kira.
Thanks for having me.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.